So we should start again with the last session of the day, which has an economist, a physicist, and a mathematician. So we'll start by Franck.
Thank you, Jean-Philippe. Thanks for having me. I'm learning a lot today. Okay, so this is going to be about like macro analysis, and I'll try to go back and forth from some data to simple models. And this is based on you know, some ongoing work for years with those two colleagues. Paul Baudry, who is professor at University of British Columbia, but at the moment is messing up the economy as the deputy governor of the Bank of Canada. And then Dana is still at the university. So and we have been working on this quite a lot. So let me start with the novel that has inspired the most economist, which is Robinson Crusoe. And you know, that's great for economists. I mean, that's great for people doing social sciences, because Robinson is almost always alone on an island of despair, meaning that there are no social interactions. So understanding what Robinson is doing is a bit easier than with interactions. So that's a great start. And then when you read Daniel Defoe, you try to understand like the economics and the production and the fluctuations in Robinson Crusoe's economy. So as Robinson writes, from the 14th of August to the 20th, incessant rain. So I could not stir and was now very careful not to be much wet. In this confinement, I began to be straitened for food, just like in Shanghai recently. Then the rainy season and the dry season began now to appear regular to me, and I learned to divide them so as to provide for them accordingly. So, do we understand that? The idea here is that, Robinson is hit by some kind of external forces and is trying to kind of smooth out those forces as much as possible. So he's not only farming, he's also breeding, and so he's explaining that, in about a year and a half, I had a flock of 12 goats, kids and all, besides several that I took and killed for my food. But this was not all. For now, I not only had goats' flesh to feed on when I pleased, but milk too. And so he's explaining, how he's kind of like dealing with this breeding of goats to, again, try to get some regular and non-fluctuating intake of calories. So the idea here, is that on the island of despair, economic fluctuations, if they are only caused by external shocks like storms, heavy rains, lack of rains, and things like that. And if anything, what happens is a smoother version of what happens to shock. When there is, because Robinson is able to store some food, he's able to kind of breed some goats, he will typically smooth the shocks that are hitting the island. And on top of that, absent of any meteorological fluctuations, he would reach a kind of like steady, nice, and boring situation where things will repeat forever. Okay, and that is typically the way we model economic agents as taken in isolation. Preferences are convex, production sets are convex, so we aim at stability. This is also something that we can see from revealed preferences. We do actually subscribe insurances, for example. We do team up to diversify risk and this kind of thing. We hate risk. There are counterexamples. People are losing their wealth, betting on horses. But I mean, let's say that those people are more anomalies than the average. So now I want to take this island and then put like many other agents on this island and let them interact. And I won't put them all on the island because the island is too small. So let's put them all in Berlin at the beginning of the 20th century. And to keep like the analogy with breeding, I'm going to look at now once I put a lot of agents together and then they decide to breed porks. What is going to happen? And this is something that was studied by an economist in the 20s in Germany, and it's called like the hog cycle, and it became like famous in economics. And you, the guy is trying to do things like very carefully. So that's the price of pork in pork meat in Berlin. And he's, you know, he knows that there's a trend. He knows that there are some seasonal fluctuations. He's trying to take care of that. And in the end, you find those kind of like, booms and busts. And, you know, so why is it so? I mean, economists have studied this quite a lot. There's a whole, you know, literature on the so-called cobweb, which is exactly about that. And then basically the idea is that, you know, when I decide to breed a pork, it takes a year. So when I take my decision, this is based on the expectation of the price at which I will sell it. But that price is not something I'm controlling. It depends on what all the others are doing. So that price is really the, you know, like the variable that embeds, that encodes all the social interactions. And then, you know, depending on the way you form expectations, and then in the simple cobweb model of the 30s, if you assume that you form expectations based on the past, then you're typically going to, you know, react with one lag to what happened, and then you would have like overproduction of pork, and then, you know, underproduction of pork, and so on and so forth. So that's the idea of, you know, social interactions creating fluctuations in a world in which, you know, absent of those interactions, there would be no fluctuations, except those coming from exogenous sources. So that's the kind of, nothing new for people in this audience, that, you know, the sum is different from the whole is different from the sum of the parties, but that's the very idea. So the very idea that, I mean, a lot of people have been addressing, but I want to address today, is also that, you know, can it be that interactions between agents create fluctuations? And we have, you know, we've seen already some economist colleagues that answer that question. So I just want to kind of like also like look at that from perhaps a bit different angle. Can we have fluctuations? And more than that, can those fluctuations be cyclical? And I'm going to explain why this is kind of important. Boom bust dynamics. Cyclical means that, you know, when you're in the boom, you know, endogenously the economy and social interactions are sowing the seeds of the next recession, which is itself sowing the seed of the next expansion, and so on and so forth. Okay, that's the idea. So to put that into like simple schematic, let me think of the economy as being some, you know, variable X that would be at zero absent of any shocks. Okay, so the view of Robinson Crusoe in Thailand is that, oh, maybe there's something, there's a storm, and because of the storm, you know, that variable X that Robinson is trying to control is increased. Perhaps I should have decreased it, like, you know, some goats are killed, or, but anyway, it's increased. Then what has happened? Then, you know, according to this Robinson view, because Robinson hates fluctuations, he will do things accordingly such that the economy will smoothly go back to normal state, it's steady state, and stay there, absent of shock. So the idea is that, you know, the economy in that way is inherently stable, and it can be destabilized because, you know, bad things happen, we can't control everything, but when something happens that hasn't been controlled and can be thought as exogenous, then, you know, the economy will do everything to let itself land smoothly back to equilibrium. That's the view of, you know, a lot of, like, the macroeconomic models which are used in the literature, and fluctuations are mainly created by shocks, exogenous shocks. So another view, which would be more like some kind of like a more different type of view, would be that, oh, you know, no, with interactions, when you basically sum all those black lines for different individuals, then you end up having some, you know, fluctuations of that type. I call that cyclicality, meaning that absent of shocks, you know, you have like a boom, and then the boom is endogenously creating the sources of like the recession, and then the boom, etc. And this might die out eventually. So that would be a view, a kind of like semi-optimistic, semi-pessimistic view of, you know, market economies. Well, you know, they are not like really stable, but they are not like completely unstable. They are somewhere in between. You know, we're not gonna expect that the economy at some point will explode and go, you know, and go who knows where. So, I mean, a view which is a bit similar but a bit, you know, different at the same time, is that, oh no, in fact, you know, the economy is not stable, meaning that yes, there is some steady state, but if you are moved away from that steady state, then you're going to cycle forever, even absent of shock. Whether you want, you know, whether the cyclical but converging line or the other one are very different, it's not clear, because if you make the persistence very large, you know, it's not clear that in the data you can really, you know, see the difference between something which is permanent and something which is like super persistent. In particular, that was my question this morning about like in sample, out of sample. I mean, macroeconomists, we don't have like, we can't, you know, generate as many data as we want to validate our models. We have like a very few data because there's a lot, you know, there is structural change. So, you know, even if you give me data for the Middle Ages, I don't think it's going to be very useful to understand, you know, capitalist market economy. So we have, say, you know, data since, you know, World War War, since the 50s or something like that. So we don't have a lot of data. Anyway, so that's, I'm trying to, you know, so what I want to understand is, how can I think of those outcomes in models which are, I would say, so what I'm trying to do is to have models which are like simple enough so that I can understand what is going on. And then, you know, and then I'm going to go to the data again with simple models. So it's a bit of a complementary approach to approaches which are relying more on computer simulations. And, you know, this, it's not about something is better than the other. It's just like, it's, I think it's useful to attack the questions from both angles. So let me say something about cyclicality. Do we have this cyclicality in the data? And for that, I'm going to use this series, which is, you know, in the US. I'm going to look at US data. So there is this non-profit organization which is called like the National Bureau of Economic Research, who is doing many things, mainly giving money to economists to do research, but which is, you know, which has also a kind of like a group of experts which, you know, assess the state of the economy and announce to the world whether the economy is in an expansion or in a recession. You know, that's what those guys do, and they are like university professors. And so you know, for every quarter for every quarter they just, you know, they meet and then they assess the economy and then they decide whether we are in an expansion or recession. So, and then they put a zero if the quarter is in an expansion and a one if the economy is in a recession, okay? So so you see, so fortunately, you see that when you look at the data, there are more zeros than one. So most of the time, the economy is in an expansion. That's the US again. But, you know, there are like a decent amount of recessions that are kind of, are in general, you know, shorter and sharper than expansions.
But they really don't give intermediate values, the only...
Yeah. It's one or zero. Yeah. Then you could come, yeah. I think that if there is a value, it's you know, a value of having a relatively, a bold message, because if not, I mean, yeah, we can run run models and find, like, you know, probability of being in an expansion or in a recession, which are never exactly zero or one, but I think it's kind of, that's what they do. Okay, so I'm gonna look at that and I'm gonna try to see if I can find any regularity, any cyclicality in the economy in a very simple way, just by counting, basically. So this is what I'm doing. So I'm taking a quarter for which the economy was in a recession, and I look at, okay, what's the fractions of quarters in which the economy was again in a recession, you know, K period after today, okay? So if you look at this 20 here, this is telling me, okay, when the economy was in a recession in period zero, in quarter zero, 20 quarters down the road, meaning after 5 years, you know, there was a probability, 0.4, 0.3, that the economy was again in a recession. Okay, so that's what those lines are counting. And then there's a little bit of a margin. This X, because what I'm looking at is that conditional of being in a recession today, am I in a recession in K period plus minus 2 or 3? Because recessions are super short, so, you know, so you need to have like a little bit of enough observation. And so what do I see? I see this kind of a very interesting pattern, which is that, you know, conditional on being in a recession, 10 years after, you know, the probability of being again in a recession is pretty high, about like 70%. But then if you go to like 60 quarters after, it's like super low, like, you know, 10%. And then if you go like 80 quarters after, it's like super high again. So we see that this kind of like cyclicality, meaning that, you know, it's as if, you know, data was generated by some kind of, you know, sine wave with a period of 40 quarters. Okay? So that's and this is a pattern that you find, you know, also in other countries. So what does it mean, cyclicality, in the sense I'm defining? It means that, you know, as I said, if activity is high today, it's likely to be low in L over 2 period and then high again in N period. So this is not, of course, this is not deterministic, right? It doesn't mean that, oh, I know for sure that there's going to be a recession every 40 quarters. I mean, of course, that's just an empirical regularity, right? I'm not meaning that the world is deterministic. Okay, so there's a way. As I say, it's important because, you know, when you want to assess, you know, what's, you know, is that a problem that the economy is a big boom today? I mean, according to the Robinson view, no, it's great. I mean, it's a big boom today; it cannot last forever. But we're gonna kind of soft land back to the steady state. If you believe in this like kind of like cyclical view, well, I mean, we're in trouble because meaning it means that down the road we're gonna have like a big recession and so on and so forth. Other thing, you know, a lot of people tend to believe, including a lot of economists, that you know, expansions don't die of old age, and that, you know, if we're in expansion, if at some point the expansion becomes a recession, it's because, you know, someone did something wrong, and most of the time it's the fault of the government or of the central bank, you know, according to a lot of people. Well, in a cyclical world, expansions do die of old age because, as I said, you know, this idea that you know, expansions are sowing the seed of the recession. So you can look at that. You can, you know, you can just estimate like simple duration models again using the same kind of series of zero and ones. And, you know, I mean, I should say, you know, all this, we're a bit at the limit of the, you know, of the power of what we can do given the amount of data that we have. So, you know, standard statistical analysis tells us that what I'm showing you is significant, but, you know, if I had a gun over on my head and then I had to decide whether it's true or not, you know, I would say, oh, please, can we wait for another 100 of years or something before you can be sure? But, you know, that's the world in where we live. So this is, you know, this is just showing, you know, using different methods, parametric or non-parametric, but this is just showing, you know, the probability of, okay, let us look at the black line. That's the probability of an expansion ending in the next year, in the next 2 years, as a function of its age in quarters. Okay. So what I want you to take out of this thing is that it's increasing. So the longer the expansion has been, the higher is the probability that it's going to happen. Okay. So funny enough, I mean, not really funny, but so we wrote this paper. I mean, it's a very simple thing to do. It's just that people believe that it's flat. I don't know why exactly, but okay, so it's not. And so we wrote this paper, I think in 2018 or something. Oh yes, I'm sorry. 2018, and we said, you know, it's very likely that there's going to be a recession in the next year and a half or something. Boom, you know, COVID came, and so we were right. Maybe not for the right reasons, but, you know, so I won't take really credit out of this very specific prediction. It was the first time I was, you know, predicting something, and I was right for the wrong reason. Okay, so now, you know, we know that there are like more sophisticated way to look at the cyclicalities, basically, because cyclicality means also cyclicality in the, it means at a very specific autocovariance function, so we should look at spectral density, that's really what we want to look at. It's a bit at the limit of what we can do given the amount of data, but let's do that very quickly. And let me refresh your mind like super quickly. So I'm going to think of the world as being you know, linear stochastic processes, okay, that are stationary. So if my process is just a white noise, okay, so, you know, I think the easy way to think of what's the dynamic of the economy is to look at what happens if you do a shot. You know, you're at the steady state zero, epsilon is one for one period, then back to zero, you know, what has happened? That, you know, what happens here is like it's super boring, it's one and then zero again, and the spectral density is flat. So here I'm writing the spectrum, not, you know, on the x-axis I'm not putting, you know, frequency, because, you know, I'm an economist, I mean, frequency, I mean, like, I don't understand. I mean, I understand, but, you know, the units are like weird. So I'm putting the period. So it's quarters, so it kind of, you know, so a cycle of 24 quarters, I mean, I kind of understand more what it is in 6 years, okay? But obviously, you know, you can go from one to the other easily. Okay, so that here the spectral density is flat. You know, there's nothing particular at any particular frequency. So the typical way economists model fluctuations is really using those kind of like autoregressive processes of order one with like a kind of high persistence. Okay, I mean I'm exaggerating a bit, but that's that's basically what we do most of the time, and that's the impulse response. That's interesting because it's a model in which there's a lot of things going on internally. So clearly what we observe is very different from the epsilon, from the exogenous shocks, right? The exogenous shocks are really kind of like transformed by the model, and then our job is to write down the model that creates all this interesting like kind of persistence. Because if with this view of the world, you have spectral density which is strictly increasing, meaning that I should have said. So this is telling us. So here what I do, I'm basically writing this process as say a sum of sine waves, each sine wave having a specific period, and this is telling me, the importance of each of these sine waves in generating my data, to make it like very simple. And so this is telling me, it's really like the long periodicity, the low frequency that explains most of the data. And you see that this is my Robinson Crusoe Island economy. Okay. Now you could have like a process which is relatively simple. It's just like it's autoregressive of order two, so that it has like a pair of complex eigenvalues, and then you start getting. I mean, so this is of course this is not economic theory, because then the whole thing is to understand why do I how can a model, how can interaction between agents generate this? But that's going to come later. And so we can see these oscillations. And what is interesting is that those oscillations, so here that I made, everything is like made up so that the periodicity is about 30 quarters or something. Yes, exactly. So, and you see that the spectral density in that case, has a peak at this frequency, at this periodicity. So, So one way to see whether there is indeed cyclicality in the data, whereas there are those kind of like booms creating the next burst, etc. The data is to check whether we find like peaks in spectral densities of macroeconomic time series. Okay, so in practice, what is very likely to happen is that you have different phenomena, and then, so what a good description of the data is something where you have this kind of like persistent bit plus this cyclical one, and you add the two, and then you get spectral density of that type, which is globally increasing, but with this peak at. This is what we typically call business cycle frequency. Yeah. Okay, so if we look at the data, so I'm going to look at. One thing is that those guys are kind of like make sense only for stationary time series, right? And if we look at series like income per capita, that's not stationary. There's a trend. So we need to kind of think of series that are, that are typically reasonably second order stationary. So one is hours per capita, how much we work per unit of time per person. That's the US again. So here you see, you see the series. So those gray bars are the ones, the NBR ones, the recessions, okay? And the white intervals are the NBR expansions. And so we see several things. We see that obviously there's a lot that has to do with demographics, which changes in female labor market participation, sociology. I mean, a lot of things. And those are those long waves, long movements in our world. And then there are things which are at some kind of higher frequency, which might be more interested from the point of view of a macroeconomist, of a short run of a business cycle macroeconomist, which I am. So nice thing with spectral density estimation is that that's exactly what it's meant to do. Spectral representation is to kind of look at the different sine waves at different frequency of that guy. And if you estimate that, this is what you get. So here I'm truncating here because then it's going up again, because obviously I should have said. I mean, perhaps if you were paid by the theory that explains the maximum of the variance of that series, you want to be a sociologist, right? Because, you know, most of the variance is this long wave, right? Which has to do, as I said, with, you know, family, with like gender equality within the household, this kind of thing. But for some reason, you know, I'm not so much interested in money, so I'm not looking at, not trying to explain the this. So this is to say that, you know, most of the spectral density will be maximum for relatively, you know, high periodicity, okay, obviously. But in the short run, you see that, oops, I'm sorry, you see that you have this peak here around 40 quarters, okay, which tells me, oh, there's something cyclical around here. And interesting enough, this 40, if you remember, is the 40 that I was finding when I was doing this count of, you know, using the 0 and the 1s of the NBR. So it's really, it has really to do with this business cycle as defined by you know, those guys that are supposed to, yeah, they are like a bit the popes of business cycle analysis. They define things. Okay, fine. So that's interesting. And then this is something that is pretty pervasive that you find in a lot of other series. Let me just show you one for, you know, in financial series too, that's the delinquency rate. I'm going to use that later. So there are a lot of series in which you do find this peak at business cycle frequency around 40 quarters every 10 years. Eh? So you should expect a recession every 10 years. You know, of course, you know, it's not like deterministic. And yeah, okay, good. So now the thing is, okay. So can I think of like a simple and standard framework that in which, you know, cyclicality appears as the consequence of interaction. So this is what I want to do here. I'm going to use a model which will be simple. I mean, very simple, and then I'll tell you how we do a bit more in the real world. I'm not going to do everything I was planning. I mean, I was not planning to do everything anyhow. So I'm going to set the scene with this kind of reduced form model, and then, you know, not sure I will do I will do 2 and 3, but it doesn't matter. Okay, so let me start with it. So I'm gonna tell you a model, and it's, so you can think of it as a kind of agent-based model. People are just doing things because that's, you know, they routinely behave that way. There are certain heuristics. Or you can think that this is the outcome of some very clever agents, you know, optimizing along several dimensions. That's what I'm gonna do later, but it's gonna give the same reduced form, so we can work with this. And so this is, okay, so this is a model which has like two variables. So first, there is a stock variable. So it's something. So I have, you know, this is Mr. I at time t plus one, time is discrete. And, you know, this stock variable is the depreciated stock of the previous period plus, you know, the effort I made during this period. So this variable is some kind of is a kind of sum of past efforts. So think of it as this is my stock, you know, this is the amount of square meters that I have in my house, okay? And this is, you know, how much I work, how much effort I do working, and then the more I work, you know, I mean, the more I buy, you know, larger houses. And then, you know, they depreciate somehow. So those are like kind of houses that melt or something like that. Okay, good. So this is like a kind of like a physical equation, right? I mean, it has nothing to do with choice. That's the way it is. Think of cars, perhaps. Cars is a better example. Okay, and then you know, I'm interested in this effort. So think of it like maybe working, deciding to work or deciding to invest, of course. Okay, and then works. So there are some an interesting constant, but work will depend on two things. So one is you know, what I dislike, and this comes from, you know, either psychology or from, you know, more kind of like axiomatic way of seeing preferences. You know, I typically, you know, preferences are concave, so I dislike to do things very differently from the previous period. I don't like ups and downs, okay? So this alpha 2 is positive, is telling me that I tend to do relatively similarly as compared to the previous period, okay? So here, how do you model that? Typically, it's called like habit persistence in preference theory. It's the idea that, you know, or addiction, sometimes it could be called, the more I have consumed in the past, the higher today is my desire to keep on consuming. So if it was cocaine, that would be literally, you know, the more cocaine you had in the past, the more you want today because, you know, because you're just hooked, right? But this works also for, you know, other things like have a nice car, nice house, you know, drinking good wine and things of the type, which are not drugs. Okay, then the second thing is, you know, how do I react to my stock? So when I have a, you know, when I have like, you know, a super large TV, flat TV set in each of my rooms in my house, you know, do I want to work more to have an extra one or not? So if this alpha one is negative, it means that, you know, the more I have, the less I want at the margin, okay? Well, so that's what I call like the kind of durable good house type of behavior, you know. This, you know, once I have like a castle, you know, once I have like a great apartment in Paris plus a cottage in Normandy plus a summer house in Côte d'Azur, maybe, you know, I'm not going to work night and day to have like a fourth, or maybe I want something in the mountains, right, for the winter holidays. But after that, I promise, you know, I stop, you know. There's no point, you know, going on over and over. So that would be a kind of like alpha one negative. But this alpha one could be positive. It's more like it's kind of capital view of the world. You know, so I work hard, and because I work hard, I can buy more and more efficient, you know, machines to operate. And if I have more efficient machines, I'm even more productive, so I have an incentive to work even harder. So that's also possible. And, you know, we'll see that, you know, the dynamic is pretty different depending on whether we are in that case or not. Okay, so that's it. So let me make a bunch of assumptions. First assumption, parameters are such that absent of interactions, which is here, there are no interactions, you see, I mean, there is only Mr. I by itself. Do you know, there's a steady state to that economy, which is stable, and there is smooth convergence. So it's Robinson, okay? So that's what happens. You know, absent of interactions, you know, things are smooth and boring. Now, this could be discussed. We could, you know, you could tell me, no. It's, you know, people, they love roller coaster type of life. Some do. You know, from revealed preference, it seems that not the majority. So now I'm going to add in a super, like, you know, simple way, I'm going to add, you know, this F here, which is like, you know, which tells me that now what I do also depend on what the others do on average, okay? That's, it's like super simple way of modeling it. You can do better, but I mean, you can always do things in a more complex way. That's a theorem. Okay, so here, that is the only thing that will be nonlinear. And okay, this is telling me, for example, think of this is what, you know, what the others are doing on average. It could be when I look at prices, what prices are encoding is basically what the others are doing in terms of supply and demand. And if I'm competitive, I'm just reacting to it. So you can think of this as being prices, for example. But you can also think of other situations in which, for example, you know, it's about whether I'm going to buy you know, a blue shirt or a red shirt. And what matters is really, you know, I don't want to look stupid. If everyone has a red shirt, I don't want to have a green one. So it's like fashion. So what the others will do in terms of, you know, having a red or a blue shirt, I have to do the same, right? Or I have to, you know, or to be different, depends on, really depends on many things. So that's the idea. And then, so I'm going to parameterize everything. I'm going to look locally at what is going on, you know, locally around the steady state. I'm going to parameterize things by this rho, which is the slope of this F at the steady state. Okay, I'm going to explain what it is. I mean, it's basically telling me around the steady state, when the others are doing more effort at the margin, when the others are increasing their effort by one unit, I'm increasing my effort by rho unit. Okay, that's what it means. And I'm going to, you know, normalize things so that when I change this slope, the steady state stays the same. I mean, it's a bit irrelevant. I mean, it's just for the sake of the presentation. So here's what can happen. So this is, you know, that's my behavior, okay? So in that behavior, XIT, it's the stock I'm inheriting from the past, it's given. I cannot change it today. My past action, I cannot change it today. So this part here, that's history. So as of today, there's nothing I can do to change it, okay? So today, what I should do is a kind of game. So I should decide of what to do as a function of what the others are doing, right? And I'm going to look for an equilibrium to kind of like an equilibrium to this. So let's assume that my F function is decreasing, so my rho is negative. So this is, you know, this is what I do as a function of what all the others are doing. That's the, you know, history. I cannot change it. And then, you know, this guy here, this function F is decreasing, and I'm going to look at symmetric equilibrium because everyone is the same. So that's going to be the equilibrium of the system, and it's called like a period T equilibrium. Here, equilibrium means equilibrium in the sense of, you know, economist, not in the sense that the system won't move, but in the sense that this is when where all decisions are compatible. Okay, it would be a Nash equilibrium if I had, framed everything as a game here. I mean, I didn't tell you anything about pair function, but that would be what you would have in the game. So that's a possible situation. It's called like strategic substitutabilities. So that's what happens in competitive equilibrium.
You want to stay
5 minutes, okay. So I have to
leave.
Yeah. So I'm going to speed up. So what does it mean? It means that, so if suddenly everyone else loves apples, everyone will buy apples, that's going to push up the price of apples, and me, I'm going to reduce my quantity of apples, okay? So my behavior will be negatively related to the others. So this is creating stability, okay? And then another possibility is that, I'm following the crowd. But I'm following the crowd, but less than one to one. So if the others decide to eat one more apples, I'm gonna follow you guys, but only 0.9. I will eat only 0.9 more because you never know. So I'm gonna call this weak complementarities. What I'm ruling out is okay. So there's another. Okay, no, it's one. So under the assumption that this row is smaller than one. You can prove that there's a unique equilibrium, a priority equilibrium. And then what I'm ruling out are situations in which, in which at some point my row, which is the slope here, is bigger than one, meaning that, you do that, I'm gonna do even more. But everyone will do even more, so the equilibrium will the total will be even more, so I'm gonna react by doing even more, et cetera, et cetera. And then typically you end up having multiple equilibria here. I'm gonna roll this out. Okay. Let's say that it's I'm deciding to return. So then what we do, so let me just tell you this proposition. And then what we do is that, so we start from rho equals zero, meaning Robinson Crusoe, and then we're increasing rho, or decreasing rho, we're creating interactions. So first, if we create interactions in the way perfect competition does, what you can show is that the system remains locally stable and it's even converging faster to the steady state. So, competition, perfect competition is creating a lot of stability, even more stability than what you would have without interactions. Now, if you now increase the rho, you increase complementarity between agents, you stay below one, but you increase complementarity, you can prove that at some point the steady state will become unstable. Okay? So you will have like a bifurcation there. And so, because I kept this F nonlinear, I'm going to be able to look at local nonlinear dynamics. And interesting thing is that what you can have is basically when this alpha one is negative, meaning that when the more you have, the less you want to have at the margin, then you're going to have cycles, endogenous cycles, and they could be either up down or smooth cycles. Depending on whether you like to smooth things, that's basically the same type of thing. And now, on the contrary, if the more you have, the more you want to do, then you're going to create a multiplicity of steady states. Then the idea is that, the more you want, the more you have, the more you want to do, everyone does that, and then we go away from the steady state and get somewhere else. And so this is giving you so-called hysteresis, meaning that then shocks will have permanent effects. So what you could have, and again, everything is like super boring to start with. I haven't introduced like crazy hemp-shaped, bell-shaped functions or nothing, right? So what you have is that either you have two cycles, steady state is always unstable. Either you have like limit cycles of that type, either you have the emergence of two other equilibria, those two ones become those two ones become stable, this one unstable, and you're gonna have like basin of attraction. If you start from here, you're gonna go there. If you start from here, you're gonna go there. So you're gonna get interesting dynamics. So let me skip all this. One thing which is, okay, let me skip all this. Now let me show you just, one thing. So now we build a model which is, I'm not going to tell you anything about the model. It's a model in which we believe that agents are super, super smart. They optimize over an infinite horizon. They know exactly what will happen. They are like, they are really like super smart. They interact, and there are reasons for why, they are strategic complementarities, and we estimate that model, trying to fit, this spectral density of ours, right? So, and that's what the model does. So what the model does is like this is smooth line, and so once you do that, it took like a few years to develop the model, so I'm not expecting to present it today. So that's typically, one sample draw, US data, post-war US data. That's a sample draw of what the model generates. Interesting thing, if we shut down shocks in that model, then you're going to get that. So indeed, you find that, the economy here, it's really, it's really kind of like unstable, not exploding, but kind of unstable. So it's fluctuating, not because of shocks, it's fluctuating because of its internal dynamics. We need shocks because, this is like a purely deterministic and predictable economy. That's not what we see. But shocks here are not there to create fluctuations. They are there to create the absence of total predictability of what's going on. So it's a very different view of the shocks. And interesting things now, and that's why, I guess economists are paid for, perhaps, or I don't know, we wish we were paid for that. What you can do is that you can look at, a policy parameter is some monetary policy. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but by changing that policy parameter, so this is what is happening without shocks. By changing this policy parameter, you can basically make the economy more stable. And making the economy more stable is not, is not basically trying to contract shocks, but it's trying to change this kind of internal propagation of the economy that makes it locally unstable and globally stable. I think I'm going to stop here. Thank you very much.